Dr. Goswami.
Good morning. Thanks, Dr. Uko, for organizing this colloquia on an important topic on tropical fruits. What I'm going to do is I'm going to cover some of the important issues happening in the global level on food and nutritional security, and what are the efforts we need to take to increase the fruits and vegetable consumption, again, which is related to the nutritional security, and also the prevalence and prevention of chronic disease by eating more fruits and vegetables, and how these tropical fruits and vegetables play a role in that food security. And I'm going to use an example of one of the tropical vegetables, how such vegetables can be explored to the fuller potential to address this nutritional food security. And then I'm going to touch at the end just an example of what we do at Texas A&M using one of the vegetable and maybe another example of the fruit, which are really not completely tropical, but they're kind of subtropical. And one, of course, vegetable is tropical. I'm just using an example at the end. So I think in the last 10 years, most of you know that the food and nutritional security definitions are kind of defined by each person, and sometimes it's getting confused. Sometimes even I don't know exactly how to define food and nutrient security at a global level. But there is a World Health Organization kind of use those terms to make sure that at the global level everybody is addressing the same issues. So when all people at all times have access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food, that's really basically the food security. That is, again, as long as if it maintains the healthy and active life. So when you address the nutritional security, it is simultaneously we need food, health, and care. And one thing we need to be remembering, these two terms are always interchangeable. Sometimes we get confused. Without the nutritional security, food security is at a household level is impossible. So we need to have both. Of course, nutritional security is part of the food security. So, again, WHO considers these three or four aspects, the availability, access, and utilization, and stability, in order to address the household, and it's a basic human right. So if you really consider these three terms are used, or four terms used, sometimes they're interlinked, but at the same time, you can see the flow. Unless we have a stability of availability of the food, access to the food, and utilization of the food, you cannot achieve the nutritional security. So it's a little bit interlinked, and at the same time, it goes one way also, the three aspects. So the food security is a bigger challenge, and of course, at the global level, there is a lot of political discussion happens, and some countries get lose the elections because of the food security. India is an example where there's a food security bill recently. There's a big debate from both parties. So it is a geopolitical aspect. At the same time, in scientific sense, it has some role with the climate change. For example, if you look at the data here, most of the developed world, since they're not really facing food security. Having said that, this chart is kind of, in my opinion, is not the perfect way. Even in the United States, we have about almost 15% undernourished or malnourished people. So a lot of people, when you go to the other countries, they don't really see that happening. So if you look at the global impact of the food security, about 36 million people are having a lack of food, and about 29 million people have too much food. So that's why we have about 1.5 billion people in the global level are obese, are overweight, and about almost 868 million people are undernourished. So we are really facing the double burden in this sense. It's a malnutrition and malnutrition as well as the obesity. Both are challenges in the global level. So this is, of course, a little bit old data in 2005, but you can see that the graph shows, or the chart shows, the obesity is a major problem in the United States. But if you really dig deeper on individual data, it's not true, actually. If you look at some of the developing countries, in the statistics, it says only just 15%. Even this chart says that. But in reality, in some of the developing countries, the obesity is also about 30%. So even though we consider that only U.S. has this major problem, actually a lot of the other developing countries are also facing obesity and malnutrition, actually, both in the same country. That's really a challenge for them, actually. So what is the impact of this undernutrition or food insecurity on the human health is basically there is a lot of challenges. Basically, we lose weight, deficient growth, decrease in immunity, and several other diseases. And at the same time, you can see that nutrient loss, poor absorption, and metabolic alteration, which leads to basically the occurrence of diseases. It could be any chronic diseases, of course. As we all started imagining, the cost or the impact, global impact is big on the obesity. But at the same time, we're not addressing the challenge in a severe way. And I say severe way, in a serious way to address this. So it costs about $190 billion. And at present, about 69% of the adults are overweight or obese. About 78 million people in the United States are considered as obese. About 17% of the children are obese also. So if you look at the cost, I think the medical cost, this is an average, of course, it could be probably 10,000. It's not like, just like 1,400. But on an average basis, about $1,479 is extra spent by the people who are obese to be maintaining the lifestyle. So there are several diseases listed here. I think most of you know that the major three consequences of the obesity is heart diseases, cancer, and diabetes. But we're just underestimating the impact of that. I think there are other challenges you face here is even mental health condition and infertility and osteoarthritis as well as sleep. A lot of other effects are also there, even though the medical scientists communicate only three major impact, but I think obesity leads to other problems too. So what is the silver bullet? And I'm not here to state that just fruits and vegetables take care of the obesity problem. Still, we need to have a lot of scientific evidences to prove that fruits and vegetables play a role in reduction of the obesity. There are some evidences, but not 100% complete. There are evidences on the heart health, but not really on obesity yet. But still, if we can recommend people to eat more fruits and vegetables, here in this chart it says 3 to 5 servings. Eat right is another slogan we have been using it. And you can see that 3 to 5 servings, fruits and vegetables, and also at the global level, each country, I don't want to say each country, some countries in the global level have been using this food guide pyramid, like United States uses this. Australia uses about almost not half of the plate, about 33% of the plate is fruits and vegetables, if you look at the right side. And in the Europe, again, it's in European style, the recommendation is still not 33%. Maybe it's 33%, but maybe about 30%. You can see that most countries are campaigning for this, but the big challenge I'll tell you in a minute. And you, of course, the United States kind of evolved over the years since from 1980. We recommended 3 to 5 servings per day a few years ago, and in 1990s we kind of changed those. One time we said women has to eat 13 fruits and vegetables per day servings, and women has to be 11. Then we changed more the matter. That was our slogan. In 2011, we changed it to my plate. That means half of the plate has to be fruits and vegetables, so that people do not have to count anything. At least if your plate is half that fruits and vegetables, you're okay. So that was our campaign in the United States. But the challenge is, with all this money we spent on educating people to eat fruits and vegetables, my question to you as an audience now, how many of you eat even 5 servings of fruits and vegetables as a horticulturist? So only 4. So I can say that 30%. So the big challenge I'm posing here to all of you is, we as educators, and we are a horticulturist, I believe, right? If we do not have 100% eating fruits and vegetables, how do we expect people to eat more fruits and vegetables? It's a challenge. I'm not trying to blame anybody, but that's the challenge we have. We have been talking that horticulture is good for part of the life, but our servings and consumption is almost, you can see that it's very low with the 15 years of our effort. So And again, you can see that the U.S. fruits and vegetable consumption is increased a little bit, but then again decreased. But I can tell you one statistic tells, if we increase fruits and vegetables from 400 grams, like right now that was in 2000, it decreased in 2010. If we increase from 400 to 600 grams per day, we can reduce about $2,500 healthcare cost. That's very clear evidence there, per person. So we don't really, of course, then we think, okay, fruits and vegetables are expensive. I hear that complaint from some of the people, and the industry says that's cheaper, of course. So it's all a thing, but we're not increasing fruits and vegetables in the United States as well as in other countries also, even with a lot of effort. So even, I think Michelle Obama started this home gardens. Even then, we are still not consuming, even the homegrown vegetable consumption is decreasing. There must be something wrong. As I said, we are good in educating, we are good in preaching, but we're not really following it. So, again, there's a trend here in U.S. If you look at certain states in 2009, the vegetable and fruit consumption in certain states, I think it's just a highlighted part. You can see that this slide, and if you look at the similar states had obesity problem, actually, because of the low consumption of fruits and vegetables. Having said that, I want to make sure that you don't misguide. This is not really comparison between obesity or fruits and vegetable consumption. It's just a trend. We don't have a full evidence that as you have lower consumption of fruits and vegetables, there's no increase in obesity. But this is a trend in those states at least. And I'm going to use some of the example. Okay, what happens if we do not eat enough food, particularly fruits and vegetables? So this is an example where the diabetes is increasing. One in three in America will be having diabetes very soon. You can see that about 592 million people will have diabetes. I don't want to say will have, may have diabetes by 2035. So that's a very interesting statistics. So how as a horticulture can play a role? Yes, there's a list of things. I'm not going to go through all of that, but definitely fruits and vegetables can play some role in prevention of diabetes. People may ask, okay, there are some fruits may increase diabetes because of the sugar. But we have to be very cognizant of what, making sure that all our diet is controlled, not just only fruits and vegetables. You can't eat 10 fruits and not eating vegetables, of course, and then expect the prevention of diabetes. So this is another best example how the fruits and vegetables play a role in several diseases. So one by one example is one is coronary heart diseases. What it shows here in this slide is interesting. As you increase from 3 to 4 servings per day, you can see the decrease in heart diseases. Of course, as you increase to 8 servings, you can see about 30 to 40% reduction in the coronary heart diseases. This is an example of a lot of studies combined together. It's not just one study. So this is another example of the stroke. You can see that there's a 10% reduction in the stroke if you increase from 1 to 3 servings of fruits and vegetables. You can see that on the right side here on the graph. And there's a challenge is even the heart disease. You can see that if we're having a lower fruits and vegetable consumption, there is a 31% of the population will be under risk of the heart diseases, and of course other diseases, you can see the list, but 31%. So if we increase the optimal dose of the fruits and vegetables, you can maintain the heart disease at least under control. So that's a very clear indication that fruits and vegetables play a bigger role in heart disease than cancer. Of course, we need more evidences or more proof of concept on cancer prevention by fruits and vegetables, but the heart disease is very clear. So now the question is how these tropical fruits and vegetables play a role in our human health, and can these be functional? Again, there's a big definition of functional and dysfunctional foods, right? So, and also what are the challenges and opportunity for us as a horticulturist to address this food and nutritional security in future? So this is an example where the global vegetables, for example, the China and India are on the top, and the Brazil is almost the next. In terms of the production of vegetables, and there's a big impact about in China, they have about $128 billion dollar impact on the just vegetables. So they're really in big in vegetable production. So this is an example also how the world import trade is changing. This data is from 1990 to 1990, and 1980 to 90 on the left side bar graph. and the right side is 1990 to 2000, even though there is a reduction in import of selected fruits, what you see on the right side bar graph is in tropical fruits, there is a very small reduction. So the tropical fruit import is still increasing, even in when you compare to the other vegetables or fruits. And the top seven countries importing tropical fruits and vegetables is, of course, United States. So the bigger impact is, again, you can see that developing countries account for 98% of the total production, and developed countries account for 80% of the food import or global imports. So what is that indicates is tropical fruits and vegetables are important. There's a lot of things we'll be kind of doing a lot of this economic trade with the countries. So that means we have to be addressing how these tropical fruits and vegetables play a role in our health. So why tropical fruits? I think, as you know, just like any other fruits, not necessarily only tropical fruits, these play a role in providing us some good vitamins, minerals, and fiber, along with other benefits. When I say other benefits, I'm talking about phytochemicals beyond what the normal nutrition. So mango is one of the dominant fruit crop. Yesterday, Jeff gave a very good talk in one of the workshops, and also followed by pineapple and avocado and papaya. And there are other fruits, lychee, rambutan, guavas, and passion fruit. So most recent increase in consumption of these fruits and vegetables in this country is because of the, again, export. That's why everybody is growing in even developing country and trying to export it. Interesting, sad part is, which because I come from a developing country, a lot of developing country people, they grow, and unfortunately they cannot afford to eat in rural areas. That's a challenge actually they're facing. That's probably one of the reasons I show the malnutrition figure. So why tropical fruits are more probably getting imported? If you have not tasted mango, and if you tasted apple, and if you don't like the messy or anything, then of course it's a challenge. But if you are okay with the messy fruits, mango is more flavorful than apple. I'm not trying to demonize the apple because it's handy and it's user friendly. But mango is more tasteful, and if it is, of course, if you get the right variety. So the flavor plays a big role in tropical fruits. And I'm not just talking about mango, but most of the tropical fruits. The flavor plays a big role in attracting a lot of these consumers. So another important thing is we all expect that fruits and vegetables give a role, and we always, like when we drink orange juice, we always expect that it is giving us vitamin C, right? But what we are not, at least we're getting cognizant in the recent years, is each of these fruits and vegetables have about at least minimum of 200 compounds. If you really dig deeper, any fruits and vegetables for that matter. So if you take this list, this is there in most of the fruits. So carotenoids, at least 10 carotenoids in each fruit. Again, we probably know only 2 or 3 now. We have to dig deeper. So pectin is most in the, and flavonoids, at least 20 flavonoids in each some of these fruits. So like if I take grapefruit, we have about 265 compounds. If I take bitter gourd, there are about 225 compounds. So we need to explore the benefits of these. That's why we have to eat fruits rather than just one tablet of vitamin C. Okay? So this is an example of the antioxidant activity of some of these tropical fruits, including some of the crops we grow here. You can see that some of the tropical fruits antioxidant activity. And the total phenolics, again, there's a trend. You can see that there's a fruit, red icon beans, that has about almost in the moderate quantity of the total phenolics. Again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each slides. But you can see the diversity of the tropical fruits and vegetables. Again, these are some of the common names. You may not be aware of common names, but like, for example, bitter gourd is called bitter melon in U.S. mostly. In India, they call it bitter gourd. I'm going to spend a few minutes on bitter gourd so that you'll have an idea of the importance of fruits and vegetables. But these are compounds from different fruits and vegetables. These are known, and they're also tested in the National Institute of Health in the United States now on the health benefits. So this is a slide I always use, is if we want to explore the benefits of health benefits, we need to go from ancient knowledge to the meta-analysis. That means cell culture level, animal studies, and even further on human trials, not just human trials, it has to be randomized controlled trials, and then you have to go to meta-analysis consisting of several thousands of studies, and they select about 8 studies or 10 studies based on certain criteria, then the, if the meta-analysis proves that this fruit or vegetable is good for you, then people can start increasing. So that's the big challenge we are facing, why there's still a very low consumption of fruits and vegetables. So I'm going to show you an example of some of these bitter gourd, where the studies are, and then I'll let you to conclude what needs to be done. So this is an example of the bitter melon or bitter gourd. It's extremely bitter, but it's good for diabetes. So this has, of course, other bioactive compounds. Charantine is one of the compound, memridine, visine, and carotenoids. So you can see the diversity of this vegetable. There are several varieties. And then what I'm going to show you is some of the cell culture studies and animal studies and what are the clinical trials on this bitter gourd. So this is an example. If you look at the control, and they fed these rats with one of the chemical to induce diabetes, and when they fed this, and then you can see that the Memordica Cherenci extract, MCE's Memordica Cherenci extract, from 150 milligrams to almost 600 milligrams. You can see that the last bar graphs here, when you reach to this, you can see that there's a reduction in blood glucose level. This is, of course, a rat study, not human study. So again, when you took certain extracts of this, the ethanol extract, basically mostly saponin-rich extract, and a certain specific compounds from bitter melon, you can see that there's an increase in insulin secretion at 125 milligrams with the extract, and with the compound is 25 milligrams, 25 micrograms. You can see this both compounds. So again, when you look at the insulin sensitivity, when they fed the high fat with the bitter gourd extract, you can see that sensitivity is increased after 10 weeks. And this one again, the lipid accumulation was reduced significantly even when they fed with the high fat, that means about 300 grams of fat, compared to the low fat, about 70 grams of fat. You can see that bitter gourd extract has reduced the accumulation of the lipids. That's a good sign. So what it tells is there are a lot of in vitro studies, a lot of in vivo studies, that is a rat study, clinical study still under question mark. Having said that, in bitter gourd, because of the potential benefits of the diabetes, there is a lot of clinical data is there also. This next study is going to tell you about 21 clinical trials in the developing world and developing countries are done so far. Except two studies, most of the studies shown very positive results in reducing diabetes with bitter gourd. That's a good sign. The example here, again, is a controversial example where they fed this bitter gourd extract. You can see the blood sugar level is not significantly reduced. This is a clinical data. But what they did is they took the air-dried or the open-dried bitter gourd. What the question is, still they don't know what happens with the sun-drying of bitter gourd extract giving to the humans. So either composition of the compound changed, we don't know. So that's why even this study concludes that the non-significant result is could be because of the changes in the composition of the compounds when you sun-dry the bitter gourd or bitter melon. So there needs to be further studies on clinical data to prevent diabetes. Particularly if you go to India and China and other countries, they talk about bitter gourd a lot. In fact, there are a lot of evidences there that is helping in reducing diabetes with bitter gourd. So these are some products from the bitter melon. Again, the question is, in developing countries, they can come up with any product they want, even without clinical data. But if you think about India and in US and Japan and European countries, there are certain rules they have to follow. So these products are there in the market without still proof of concept. So that doesn't mean that I'm not against bitter gourd. It is important to continue the studies. So there are some evidences we needed. So this is again an example. Okay, we need to go until from ancient knowledge to the meta-analysis to really reach the bitter gourd to the market and people to increase. There are big challenges, of course, the consumption because it is bitter. So what we're doing in Texas, we never used to grow bitter melon as a commercial crop. Now one of my PhD students is working on different varieties. We tested about 12 varieties. 7 are growing very well in Texas. We also tested the ascorbic acid content. There is a variation of the ascorbic acid content here. You can see that. And also what we're doing also is we're trying to again dig deeper what compounds in bitter gourd makes this diabetes prevention. So let us hope if the bitter principle, which is memorization or challenge is not the one, then we're good because we can, by breeding, you can change that composition and make people to eat bitter melon too. So that's why we're understanding different compounds. So this is an example where we isolate the compounds. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in how we isolate the compounds. For example, we use flash separation. We tried to get these different peaks. Again, because of the time, I'm going to kind of rush this. You can see that you can collect the fraction. When I was a graduate student, I had to literally put the student. Now this thing is really an automatic method. You can collect fractions. You can isolate these compounds. If it crystallizes, great, actually. So you can see those two spots in a minute. Those are basically isolated compounds. So you can go further in isolating it. And we identified those compounds as a Charanchin. And again, there are several other compounds in bitumen you can explore. As I said, there are 225 bioactive compounds in bitumen. Do I know all of them? No. So there is another example. We talk about the green tea or some of the compounds in green tea. The best example here for this audience is ionose is one of the anti-inflammatory marker. You can see that by bitumen extract, the bitumen compounds extract, you can reduce the ionose. That's basically you can reduce the inflammation. Even with the green tea, it didn't reduce well. So the bitumen is more potent than even green tea compounds. This is an example. Even with TNF-alpha, this is one of the pro-inflammatory factor. Even with that TNF-alpha, you can reduce the ionose. That's one of the anti-inflammatory markers. So there is another crop, fruit of the gods, we call in India. It's again, the common name is jamun. Its botanical name is Caesium cumini. This is again, all parts of the fruit tree are useful. And it is a rich source of tannins, anthocyanins, phytosterols, phenolic acids, vitamins, and lignins. These are products marketed in India now. It's a popular crop in India. It's grown on a wild scale. You don't need to really cultivate. It can grow without even water in the mountains, without even a good amount of water. The studies on this one, again, just like the bitter gourd, very few clinical data. Example is there are some studies on diabetes. Again, they have shown that it can reduce diabetes and also it can reduce cholesterol. That's an example. So what is needed? And I'm skipping because I have only a few minutes left. These are challenges needed for any of these tropical vegetable or fruit. It's not just medical science, it's not just agriculture science. You need to all work together to really bring that increase in consumption of fruits and vegetables, going back to what I said in the beginning. To do that, we have to address all of these. Post-harvest, agriculture practices, and for example, in case of bitter melon, this is a bitterness, is another question. So agriculture practices starts from irrigation to application of fertilizer, how they influence these bioactive compounds, the quality and taste. Taste is important too. And again, post-harvest practices, how this irradiation, for example, if we have to import some of these vegetables from other countries. And this is a challenge with bitter gourd. It is bitter. For example, I don't like directly. My wife eats directly. That's a big challenge by each person also. I need to have some salt. So what happens if you add salt or sugar, whatever it is? So then there's a challenge. So how do you make this bitter? And the big challenge is maybe the compound responsible for the human health may not be bitter. But my assumption is anything bitter is good for you. So it is always a challenge. So anyway, so we need to get public awareness that this is good for your diabetes. Even though it is bitter, just at least take some small amount at least, something like that. We have to bring the public awareness. And also there are the diversified recipes for bitter gourd. Only problem is if you fry, what happens to the oil and the other things also. Maybe some oil may be helpful for the absorption of some of these compounds. So, and I'm just showing you one or two slides about what we do as an approach for any of these clinical data to from the farm to the consumer approach, basically. Is an example of the grapefruit study. We did a lot of work on isolation. We have a lot of publications, at least more than 50 publications on isolation of bioactive compounds from citrus. We also tested these in different types of cancer, the compounds from citrus or grapefruit particularly. I'm not going to spend detailed time on that. And again, we took some of these compounds and we modified, and you can see the GST enzyme is increased 130% in animals. The GST is one of the enzymes which is needed for detoxifying some of the toxic compounds in our body. So, and we did the clinical data. We gave the grapefruit to the obese breast cancer women, and we found that the cholesterol is reduced, particularly the total cholesterol is reduced by human clinical trial. So we did the similar studies with carrot. And again, here we developed the maroon carrot, and some of you know that it has high beta-carotene, of course, and also it has anthocyanins, which is not present in orange carrot. So when we did this clinical data, we gave it to, again, breast cancer recovering patients. The goal was to prevent the reoccurrence of the breast cancer. We gave them to drink orange carrot juice and the maroon carrot juice, their beta carotene went up above about 4 points. So if you have 4 points above beta carotene, the hypothesis by the NIH studies, the Women Health Initiative study, which is funded with $120 million, shows that if your beta carotene level is more than 4, you can reduce the chance of reoccurrence of the breast cancer. So the carrot shows an example that drinking carrot juice every day, you can prevent the reoccurrence of the breast cancer. So we approach farm to, again, consumer approach. I believe in future it's not farm to consumer. In future it will be consumer to the farm. The plate will decide what we need to eat, what we need to grow. So consumer will decide what food or what fruits or vegetables we have to grow. It's not just growing vegetables. What quality, what flavor, what health compounds should be there in vegetables. So that's the approach in future, I think. So it is going to be, trend will be changed, basically. And we approach this system-wide approach. Because of the time, I don't have details. So, but basically, we approach from breeding to crop management to nutrition to consumer preference and, again, market trend. So the market trend will give the information to back to the breeder or the physiologist to how to grow and what to grow. So that's basically we approach as a system-wide approach. So what are the opportunities? World is getting closer or smaller because of the advance in electronic age. We need to establish collaborative research to really bring these tropical fruits and vegetables, that's my talk, to the forum of the developed world. How do we do that is collaboration. We cannot grow mango in Illinois, for example. Of course, in Florida they can grow. Maybe Florida can ship to other countries, but how do we collaborate each other in other around the world? So develop multidisciplinary approach. The one approach we used is I just took Texas A&M president to Karnataka in India. We basically established two new centers. One is on foods for health, similar to what we have in Texas A&M in Karnataka. The government of Karnataka announced about $5 million in just one visit. Of course, it took me about almost 10 years to make that happen, but at least government of Karnataka announced $5 million to one of the agriculture universities where I come from, about $5 million to just to work on foods for health where a lot of these tropical fruits are unexplored. So how do they really work, and they can extract compounds, they can collaborate with scientists in the U.S. That's the goal of these two centers. So with that, I'm going to end my presentation. And again, this effort in our center is based on several scientists and students' efforts. So this is a picture I've been using it. I need to change my new picture with the new group. Thank you. Yes. Credit goes to Dr. Oko.
I think probably because of time you couldn't explain more, but in the United States, a lot of in the United States, there are so many obese people and they are poor. And I think that in a way there should be a higher correlation between obesity and lack of education. Mm-hmm. Believe me, there are places in the country that they believe eating vegetables is rabbit food. Who is going to eat vegetables?
Yes.
It is something that our education. And then another thing is that I think you agree that there are, because of unknowns about tropical foods, there are a lot of false advertising. And obese people out of desperation, they will buy anything, including the game. So your work as a scientist would be greatly helping us to understand the sophistication.
I agree. Just a quick comment. Yes, definitely I agree that in developing world, obesity is linked to the rich people and malnutrition is, I agree that even in Mexico and India, it's kind of same, mentality-wise at least. But in the United States, yes, obesity is increasing because of the food desert areas, where there are certain areas where it's lack of fruits and vegetables. They are trying to sell it in a gas station, but I think we as a country should do something. How, I think in Baltimore they started a new initiative to have this excess of fruits and vegetables to some of these food desert areas. When I say food desert areas, where there is population where depending on completely fast food or they are poor also, they cannot afford. So I think in one or two cities I heard that they are really exploring that potential, like serving these fruits and vegetables in a mobile van to some of these areas where they are not eating at all any fruits and vegetables. Yes, I agree. Yes.
Nutrition science is showing that glycemic index is extremely important in either reversing obesity or avoiding it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the most popular tropical fruits have extremely high glycemic index. They're not going to help in terms of the insulin stimulation and the adipose accumulation that it stimulates.
Mm-hmm.
So vegetables tend to be better. I'm glad you're looking at bitter melon because of what it does in that regard of insulin. But we can't take very much of that. Like you said, it's very bitter. If they could isolate the bitter principle away from the active ingredient and somehow produce and clone that,
yes.
Nor necessarily tropical vegetables, but diet in general. All of them are better than high fructose corn syrup because of the vitamins, minerals, and the phytonutrients contained.
Yeah.
But there's a trap with this glycemic index. And many of those you showed in your slides are high glycemic.
Yes.
So I'm really glad you got into the
bitter. Thank you. No, I think vegetable is an answer for diabetes. Yes, I agree. That's why I kind of pointed out. Fruits may cause, if we're eating a lot of fruits, yes, it will be a challenge for the diabetes, yes. With the time, I think we'll pass on to Dr. Uko.
Thank you, Dr. for that excellent.